Tonight on the Daily Debrief, the Mueller report is out, a legal breakdown of what it says. Plus, attorney Michael Avenatti now faces criminal charges. Also, a father kills his daughter by dropping her from a bridge.
The defendant was sane and knew exactly what he was doing.
Can the state get a conviction despite a defendant's bizarre behavior? And the prosecutor who lost a case against an Iowa man accused of killing his mother now defends his own actions.
Any argument to say that there was a discovery violation? No, just the opposite.
The nation's most fascinating cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Monday, March 25th. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. Attorneys Donald Papsy, Michael Bryant, along with me this evening. Two findings to report in a Justice Department investigation into the extent of Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. First, no collusion between the 2016 campaign of President Donald Trump and the Russian government, even though the report confirmed that the Russians launched two major attempts to skew the results of the election. Second, Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller punted the issue of whether President Trump obstructed justice, leaving that decision to the Attorney General himself. Rachel Stockman reports.
The Mueller team of lawyers worked alongside 40 FBI agents, intelligence analysts, forensic accountants, and other staff. According to a letter by Attorney General William Barr, the team issued 2,800 subpoenas, executed 500 search warrants, and interviewed 500 witnesses. Mueller turned his findings over to the Attorney General late Friday. The Attorney General's summary says Mueller's team found two major Russian efforts to influence the election and documented, quote, crimes committed by persons associated with the Russian government in connection with those efforts. Mueller concluded that the Russians hacked into Democratic Party files and published the spoils of their efforts through WikiLeaks. But Mueller did not find that the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with Russia, despite multiple offers from Russia to actually work with the campaign. Mueller did not decide whether President Trump himself obstructed justice. Mueller wrote, quote, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Attorney General Barr and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein concluded that the evidence is insufficient to establish that President Trump committed the crime of obstruction. This is Rachel Stockman reporting for Law and Crime.
And meanwhile, an attorney who has been after President Trump is himself under arrest tonight. Michael Avenatti is charged with attempting to extort $20 million from sportswear maker Nike. He allegedly threatened to use his media presence and influence to harm Nike's reputation and sought millions in payments from Nike. Avenatti is also charged in California with wire fraud and bank fraud in an attempt to pay personal expenses such as operations for his coffee business. Avenatti claims he was about to uncover a scandal at Nike. He was the attorney for the adult film star who said she had an affair with President Trump. Opening statements today in the trial of a Florida man accused of murdering his own 5-year-old daughter. 1,200 people were called as potential jurors in the case of John Johnchuk, who is accused of killing Phoebe Johnchuk by throwing her off a bridge and into Tampa Bay. The legal question here is whether the defendant is insane or whether he can be criminally held liable on charges of first-degree murder, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and aggravated fleeing and eluding officers. The day before Phoebe died, the defendant's own lawyer called authorities and said that the defendant was delusional and had a child with him. The Department of Children and Families chose not to investigate since the defendant's stepmother was also in the picture. The next day, police saw the defendant speeding toward a bridge. A reporter from the Tampa Bay Times explained the rest of what happened.
The driver ultimately pulled over on the side of the road at a bridge, got out of the car, went to the back seat, and pulled his 5-year-old daughter Phoebe out of the back seat. The officer got out of his cruiser, had his gun drawn, a little unsure about what was going to happen, and before he knew it, John Johnchuk had dropped Phoebe off the bridge. From that point forward, then there was a police chase as Johnchuk drove south into Manatee County towards Sarasota, and he was ultimately apprehended shortly thereafter. So once he was stopped, he was very calm. He wasn't panicked at all. This is what officers said in their depositions. He didn't follow directions, but he didn't disobey directions. He basically was just static. I mean, I personally don't know what that says about his mental state at the time of his apprehension. It's been well documented that he had some. He was behaving erratically prior to dropping Phoebe off the bridge. Earlier that day, he carried around this enormous Swedish Bible, and he was in a custody battle for Phoebe, and he asked the lawyer who was representing him in the custody battle to start reading the Bible in Swedish, and of course, she can't read Swedish. There was some mention that he had been salting his home to try to rid the home of evil spirits. So I think that's what the defense is going to try to lean on, to say that his mental health was deteriorating, you know, before and until he dropped his daughter.
Case led to serious questions about whether Phoebe Johnchuk's death could have been prevented by authorities, especially after Johnchuk's own attorney reported him as a risk.
She thought he was acting erratically, so she actually called both the Florida Department of Children and Families and the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. DCF has a pretty high and specific threshold for, you know, activating investigations, and they felt, based on her call, that there wasn't anything they could do. They were hamstrung by their policy and their resources. When the lawyer called the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, two deputies met Johnchuk and his daughter at the church where the lawyer said he was going next. The two deputies interviewed him. There's something in Florida called the Baker Act, which allows people to be taken into medical custody if they're a threat to themselves or to others. But the deputies didn't feel that he met the requirements for being Baker acted. And so there's really, I mean, as far as they were concerned, there was nothing they could do or no reason to take him into custody. And so they let him continue on his day.
Calls for reform based on the reporting of journalists such as Josh Solomon have led to regulatory changes in Florida. Now to the prosecution's opening statement, starting with what happened on that bridge.
So Officer Vickers pulls in about 15 feet behind the white PT Cruiser. He doesn't know what to expect at this point. The vehicle stopped on its own. A few moments later, Officer Vickers sees the defendant, John Johnchuk Jr., the man sitting right behind me, emerge from the driver's side of the vehicle. Officer Vickers at this point is expecting a confrontation because you'll remember he thought this was maybe a stolen vehicle. Never imagined what he was about to witness. The defendant exits his vehicle from the driver's side and walks toward Officer Vickers. At this point, Officer Vickers has his firearm drawn, ready for that confrontation. The defendant makes a statement. He says, "You," referring to Officer Vickers, "you have no free will." The defendant goes inside of the vehicle, and instead of retrieving a firearm or a weapon, retrieves a child. 5-year-old, blonde-haired little girl named Phoebe. Takes the child out of the vehicle. The officer can see she had just been awakened. She's clearly alive, a real child. The defendant takes her from the vehicle, turns, and then lets go. Drops her from a height of about 70 feet into the dark water of Tampa Bay. The officer heard her scream on the way down. So we know that she was alive. The defendant then goes back to the driver's side of the vehicle and flees. And that's important, and we'll talk about that later. But he flees. He knows what he has done. He has effectively murdered his child in that moment, and now he's fleeing.
Next, the prosecution attacked the defense theory that this defendant was legally insane.
The defendant was sane and knew exactly what he was doing when he committed this murder. The defendant fled the murder. He knew what he had done. And he knew he needed to leave. He knew that what he had done was kill his child, and he knew that it was wrong, which is why he had to flee as quickly as possible. There will be experts who will testify in this case, experts for the state, experts for the defense. It would be easy to look at the evidence and say, well, this sounded a little strange. Well, he did that. That sounds a little bizarre. Therefore, must be insane. That would be an easy way out. I ask you, members of the jury, to look deeper into this case. look beyond the superficial, to really look at the evidence and to look at what these experts are saying. You will not hear any evidence that he was diagnosed with schizophrenia before this murder. He had seen a psychiatrist, a man named Dr. Arthur, from 2011 to 2013. And in that time, he had been diagnosed as being bipolar, of the more depressive type, and he had an early childhood history of attention deficit disorder. The defendant heard voices telling him that he and Phoebe needed to both die, or the world would go to hell. But you'll note that only one person went over the side of that bridge, members of the jury. And I ask that you consider that when you hear the evidence in this case. The defendant, John Johnchuk Jr., committed this murder to punish his mother and the mother of Phoebe Johnchuk. He told his own mother 3 days before the murder that he would f*** up the rest of her life, and he made good on that promise.
The defense presented a recitation of the defendant's family problems and attacked the state's theory that this crime was an attempt to get back at the victim's mother.
The state has asked you to believe that John killed his daughter because he was afraid of losing her to Michelle. Now, you're going to hear that Michelle had two kids prior to having Phoebe. And her custody arrangement with her ex was, you keep one kid, I'll keep one kid. Michelle received benefits for Phoebe and had not seen her in a year, had not attempted to go to court to make contact with her, had not contacted law enforcement to make any allegations that John was keeping her from his daughter. So the actual threat of Michelle Kerr coming to take Phoebe doesn't make sense. And while John may have felt threatened, I submit it was because of his psychosis. It doesn't match the evidence. It doesn't match the facts or the history. This man suffers from a severe and persistent mental illness. Doctors Otto, Mayer, and Macklis will also tell you that because of that mental illness, he did not know what he was doing that night was wrong, and wasn't able to appreciate the consequences of his actions because he was legally insane.
My guests tonight on The Debrief are attorneys Donald Papsy and Michael Bryant. Good evening to both of you. Michael, let me start with you. The defense open seems like a pretty standard recitation of the law and the facts in this case.
It was good. It was very good. It was a story, but it was well told. There wasn't a lot of rambling, and he didn't have a script per se, but the story was clean and I think effective, yeah.
I think the same could be said for the state. I think, Donald, that this was a textbook example of an opening statement. This was everything I learned in trial advocacy. Clear, told from the point of view of a key person involved in the action, in this case, the police officer, who watched this whole thing unfold, and also refutes counter-arguments that the defense is sure to raise.
He put things out there as straightforward as he could, but I also think the defense counsel in this case did a great job. I thought she brought up the fact that he is insane. You're going to hear doctors say he's insane, and that's really the only explanation for what happened. So, and I believe that, I actually do believe that in this case.
You believe that this person is criminally insane?
And not only do I believe it, I don't know why we wouldn't want to, as a society, from the prosecutor's point of view, this person doesn't get off. The perception out there, I think, for the viewers is that you win by insanity, not guilty by insanity, you just go free. You don't. You go into a hospital, which is clearly where I think this person belongs.
So it could be seen as a type of punishment. It's just not prison. Michael, do you disagree with this thesis?
Right. I mean, it could be worse. Do you want to go to a hospital for the criminally insane? That's the one flew over the cuckoo's nest stuff. So, yeah, he's not getting away no matter what happens here.
So neither of you are buying this whole prosecution theory that this was premeditated, that he could tell right from wrong, that he fled from the scene. That is evidence to me that he knew that what he did was wrong and therefore not criminally insane.
Well, we did see one portion at the very, very end of the Vickers, the officer saw him jump over the bridge or be jumped over the bridge, is that he asked him, what happened next? He said he calmly got in the car. He said, did he calmly get in the car and go away? And he said he did, which sort of serves that he didn't really rush away. It wasn't until they chased him, which they could just say he was just running because he was just getting chased.
Interesting line in the sand there that they are going to have to differentiate. So, look, we'll be back with the panel in just a second. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, a few final thoughts on a case we've been calling Murder on the Farm. The prosecutor who litigated the case defends himself on accusations he hid evidence from the defense. That's after the break, right here on The Debrief. New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft is scheduled to appear in court this week on charges that he solicited a prostitute. Kraft's arraignment is scheduled for Thursday. He has said he will not accept a no-contest plea deal. Instead, he intends to plead not guilty. Authorities claim they have videotape of the incident. Court documents indicate Kraft must personally appear for this week's court date. Reaction today from the prosecutor who failed to secure a conviction against Jason Carter, the Iowa man acquitted on charges he killed his mother, Shirley, over money. The state's evidence was that Carter made derogatory statements and said some strange, possibly conflicting things to investigators. But the state failed to connect the dots that Carter would have received his mother's money. The money would instead have gone to the father. Here's the verdict.
We, the jury, find Jason Carter not guilty. Is that your verdict, ladies and gentlemen?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Bull, do you care to have the jury polled?
No, sir.
Very well. In light of the jury's verdict, I will enter a judgment of acquittal. Any bond previously posted by the defendant will be released and exonerated.
Today, the prosecutor who lost the case spoke to the Law and Crime Network to share his final thoughts.
I think if you talk to most prosecutors and law enforcement officers, they'll tell you, you try to solve a homicide case one of three ways, through a forensic evidence, through eyewitnesses, or through a confession. And in this case, we had none of the above. So we recognized from the very beginning that this would be a difficult case to present with the evidence that we had. But at the end of the day, we believed that we had a good faith belief that conviction was likely. And so we went ahead with the prosecution. But, you know, as soon as you're sitting there and you present the evidence, we thought we did a good job. We clearly didn't convince the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And the chips fell where they did. And you have to respect the jury's verdict. When they come back in our favor, we have to respect the jury's opinion and their verdict when they come back not guilty. It's the way our system is designed. I wouldn't have signed my name to the trial information and brought this case if I did not believe Jason Carter was responsible. With that being said, law enforcement will always continue to investigate as we get leads that are supported by the evidence. And ultimately, that's what this case came down to, was we had, in my opinion, a number of adverse rulings that allowed the defense to get into some things that we didn't believe were appropriate and we thought were persuasive to the jury. We'll have to have an opportunity once this jury panel is dismissed from their term of service. We will attempt to contact them through surveys to see exactly what they were thinking. Was this a case where they believed the defendant was innocent, or did they just simply believe the state didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt? I was amazed by the fact that when the jury came back into the jury room, half a dozen of our jurors were crying. I'd like to gain some more insight as to what that meant to them, whether or not it's just the emotion of this entire type of case, or whether or not they believed Jason Carter was innocent, or whether or not they believed I simply failed to meet my burden.
The prosecutor also explained that attention from the press led to new leads in this case. Detectives tracked those leads right up until trial. The prosecutor said it was unfair for the defense to complain about new information coming in during the case as investigators chased those leads.
There is some truth to the fact that there was new information that was provided to law or to the defense, but it was information that had been generated in the previous 3 to 4 weeks. So I think any argument to say that there was a discovery violation, no, just the opposite. We continued to investigate this case and we continued to provide the defense the reports that we had, regardless if they were exculpatory or not. We simply gave them access, unfettered access to our entire file. In addition to that, about 10 days before the trial, the defense asked for the very first time, to the best of my knowledge, all emails that had been sent by law enforcement in this case. Well, that took some time to have the state's IT people review in excess of 50,000 emails and then redact potentially confidential information and law enforcement data related to individuals. We also turned all of that over. Judge did not find a Brady violation. The defense repeatedly attempted to move to dismiss this case. The court chose not to do that, took it under advisement, was going to wait until the conclusion of the case, but there was no Brady violation found in this case. At least here in Iowa, we have a cordial relationship with the defense bar. This was not an adverse proceeding. We'll fight tooth and nail in the courtroom within the bounds of law, but afterwards, we all go back home, we all know each other's families, and we treat each other with respect. We want to be certain we have the right guy, and we were certain we did. The jury saw it differently.
The prosecutor also admitted his timeline was weak, especially after testimony from a defense doctor whose testimony we've examined here on previous editions of The Debrief. But the prosecutor pointed to other evidence he believed was strong, including cell tower information, which suggested the defendant may have been disposing of evidence. Let me bring Donald Papsy and Michael Bryant back into this case here. So interesting here, no Brady violation, but the defense asking for these emails basically right up until the eve of trial. A lot to weed through. Why not just push things off, Michael?
Well, I think they had to deal with it when they did, you know, and maybe it was a tactical, you know, tactical move. Remember, a Brady violation is a serious accusation. That's not just a little hint that you're doing something wrong. That's serious. That could be, license-taking stuff if you're proven to have done something intentionally. So I don't know if it was it was just timing or it was purposeful.
Donald, do you think the prosecutor defended himself adequately and said, wait a minute, the defense can't have its cake and eat it too if the defense asks for these additional emails, which aren't normally part of the discovery packet? Then the defense can't complain that it's getting them late because they had just asked for them.
It seemed like there was other things, too, because they said they were going on with investigations while the case was pending. I'd like to see a time period in our lifetime where prosecutors, when they realize that they don't have it, that they just withdraw the actions and not make these people go all the way to the end thinking they might go to jail for killing someone.
We just had a huge debate about this in the newsroom because, looping back to the beginning, that's basically what the DOJ just did with the Mueller report.
Right.
And you're nodding your heads both in agreement. Yes. Right, exactly. We see it at that level, but not at the local level. It's going to be interesting to see if these jury surveys come up with some new information, because in some states, prosecutors and defense attorneys can do that. It's interesting. Donald Papsy, Michael Bryant, great to have you both on The Debrief tonight. All right. Thanks a lot for joining us. For those of you watching along, you can join us again tomorrow live at 5 o'clock Eastern on the Law and Crime Network. Our live trial coverage resumes at 9 o'clock Eastern. Have a good night, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.